the deeper ground of ourselves is transmissible. And people will feel connected to themselves in some way if they're sitting with someone who is connected with themselves in the ground of their being deeper.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and we have a legendary and brilliant guest to share with you today. Dr. Richard Moss is an internationally respected teacher, author, and visionary thinker who has dedicated over 45 years to exploring the nature of human consciousness and the art of radical aliveness. I love that. We're going to definitely talk about that. In 1977, while practicing emergency medicine, he experienced a spontaneous state of illumination that irreversibly changed his life. He never returned to clinical practice. Instead, he spent decades mapping the territory of human consciousness, how we lose presence, how we suffer unnecessarily, and how we can come back to ourselves. He's presented at Harvard, Stanford, UC Berkeley, and the University of Chicago Medical School. His 7 books have been translated into 9 languages, and he's here today to talk about one of them, The Mandala of Being, Discovering the Power of Awareness. Dr. Richard Moss, welcome to The Daily Helping. It is fantastic to have you with us today.
Like your voice. Thank you. Thank you.
I teased it a little bit. I don't usually do this. Sometimes when there's a really neat part of somebody's story, I will pull it out of the bio intentionally. Man, this is so interesting and resonates strongly with me. So you were a medical doctor and you experienced a spontaneous state of illumination that changed your life. Let's jump into the Dr. Richard Moss time machine. Let's go back to 1977. Talk to us about that pivotal moment that changed your path forever.
It's so very vivid to me. I was not a seeker. I didn't know people. You know, I hadn't, you know, heard about Saul on the road to Damascus, who becomes illuminated and becomes Paul. You know, I hadn't heard about those experiences. I hadn't heard about transformations and near-death experiences. I wasn't really aware of Buddha sitting under the tree until illumination happened in his process and so forth. But suddenly something started to happen. And I had a little bit of exposure to things like alternative aspects of medicine, like what now we take for granted and use therapeutically, like Reiki, touch for health, things like that. The ability for individuals to share energy with other people by shifting their state of consciousness. There are even insurance companies now will actually cover treatment for Reiki because it does help with pain and many other things. And some of your listeners may have heard of it. So I had touched into that. I was looking at those kinds of things. And then suddenly one day, literally, I was reading a book, the letters on the book. It was a book about consciousness written by a man named Franklin Merrill Wolf. I was on my way to visit him. He was an American mystic. He was about 89 years old around that time when I went to visit him. And I'm reading the book, and then the letters start jiggling. And it's as if I'm erupting like a volcano with energy. It's like my body is beginning to dissolve and shake. I walked outside and I sat down and I was looking at things and they were just glowing like from within, like a fire. I was actually pretty terrified. And being a doctor, I said, well, this isn't a seizure disorder and I have a witnessing consciousness. I'm not psychotic. I don't believe that an adrenaline secreting tumor is going to cause this to happen. You know, I don't know what's happening to me. I don't know what's happening at all. And very coincidentally, Episcopal priest gave me a copy of the Synoptic Gospels, an American version, and I had been reading them just a month before, and I had been crying, not knowing why, just sort of tears of recognition. I'm not a religious person. And I asked myself, if this isn't psychosis or seizures, and I don't know what this is, and I had done part of a psych residency, and I'd, you know, viewed schizophrenia and been with people. So I said, well, who's been here before? And the words came to me, Christ or Jesus, the Christ consciousness. So I said to myself, well, I need to find out what this is, or I need to somehow get here. Because with this happening to me, I was just overwhelmed. And there were other synchronistic things that happened, but I sat down and I watched my mind, and I'd say, now I'm in the past, remembering how I was. Now I'm in the future, afraid of what's happening to me. Now I'm looking at myself as if I'm a clinical specimen. Now I'm doing this. And I just kept watching my mind and talking to myself. This is what my mind's doing. This is what my mind's doing. And then I was at a friend's home who just out of nowhere came along. She was a Jungian analyst, 22 years older than me. And she knew it was some kind of a spiritual opening that I didn't know. I'm sitting in the backyard of her house, hadn't had much sleep for about 5 days, and I see two butterflies dancing in the air. One of them is dark, one of them is light. They land on a branch not more than a meter and a half from me, and they're mating. I can see them mating. And then they break apart in the air, dance around, and the dark butterfly, the black butterfly, lands right in the middle of my forehead, and boom. It's impossible to describe. Instead of a being on the inside looking out at the world, the inner and the outer became a single one. It was the most extraordinary sense of peace, of stillness, of being in touch with the universe, the one sound, the one note. And it reorganized, which I didn't understand, but over months and years I understood, it started the reorganization of my consciousness. Then after that, I came across a lot of literature of these kinds of experiences with people. So that's what happened to me. And that's why I wrote one of my books called The Black Butterfly, describing that event. And I've been very quickly after that, I started to talk to people and they were attracted to me and they started sitting with me. And we began to do, you know, long one-day things on a weekend and then short, you know, weekend retreats. And eventually for nearly 50 years now, I just worked with people in groups, in retreats, 10 days, 3 days, 2 weeks, a month. And that's where I lived these last 40-something years. It's slowed down now. And it was the first of three experiences of that nature. And I think, you know, my ego didn't get enlightened. I was still, you know, at times, as I should say, ass-holy, you know. But my consciousness was no longer identified with Richard as a separate self. It was organized around a relationship, consciousness or awareness as a relationship. I had a relationship with my thinking, so I could change it. I could watch it. I could see, oh, these kinds of thoughts are closing my heart. I don't want to go that direction. These kinds of thought are putting me in the future, making me anxious. I don't want to go in that direction. And so I just kept practicing presence and teaching out of what I was experiencing. And that's a kind of map of what happened. And of course, now we know that, you know, the people, the 2% of people that jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and survive are radically changed. We know that, I know some people are radically changed by what's now called plant medicines or psychedelics. And there's a giant rush to be using that clinically. And I think some of it will be useful. But I had no drugs, no particular stress, no falling off a bridge. It just happened. I was 30 years old.
What I find fascinating about this experience is that you, because you had the medical training as a physician, were able to rule out what it's not, right? And so it's Occam's razor, right? If you remove everything else, what's left, the most reasonable thing is there. And so what you described is what a lot of people describe when they have these spiritual awakenings. But now it's interesting that you mentioned the plant medicine, because I think science is starting to catch up to a lot of these things. You know, now quantum science is talking about that consciousness might not have this temporal anchor, right? That is to say, time might be happening in the past, the present, and the future all simultaneously. We have real PhDs saying this now, and now they're starting to be able to prove it, which is fascinating, right? And then the altered states of consciousness with plant medicine is now becoming very, very prominent. You're seeing it everywhere. You know, we haven't seen it at Costco yet, where you can buy your plant medicine. That's to me kind of the bar of if something's hit the mainstream. But you see a shift. And so this happened to you at a time when this was all taboo. And if you had probably told it to the other people on staff at the hospital, somebody would have had you committed, right?
They could have, yes. Well, they would have just, they couldn't have me committed because I was always very rational. And I mean, my persona was operative. It just that for a little while, my persona was dissolved into the infinite. And when that happens, you are just consciousness. You are just awareness. And in some sense, you are just love. And it's not sentimental love. It's just the coherence of the universe is love, and you know it. And you know it for the first time in a way that's extraordinary. You're right. There wasn't a whole lot of places I could go to ask for what's happening to me. In fact, one teacher, also an MD, a guy named Brew Joy, very interesting teacher in the 70s, 80s, 90s in the LA area, who had, you know, he'd been trained at Johns Hopkins and had left medicine to do an exploration of consciousness. I'm not sure what that evolved, how that moved for him. But when I called him and I knew him, he said, this is not territory I know. I don't know how to help you. But the man I was visiting, Franklin Merrill Wolfe, had had an experience like that 40 something years before. And when I sat with him, the man whose book I was reading at the time when this first started erupting, when I sat with him, there was an integration. So there's something that happens where we induct people to a different state and we can be stabilized in this. And because you're so, you know, and I am as well, so into helping people, you know, the main instrument by which we help people is the quality of consciousness that we sit in, no matter what we do. The deeper ground of ourselves is transmissible. And people will feel connected to themselves in some way if they're sitting with someone who is connected with themselves in the ground of their being deeper. And even that kind of language is only now becoming more acceptable. It's certainly there in Buddhist teachings.
Now, this is excellent stuff. Before we get into the book, there was something from your bio that was really intriguing that I said I wanted to come back to. The art of radical aliveness. Talk to us about that.
Well, the word radical has got a bad word, you know, the radical left, the radical, you know, but radical means core or root. So what is the root of our aliveness? Well, those that have read The Power of Now, you know, the present moment is the root of our aliveness. When an athlete forgets that they're doing anything, you know, and they're fully in the present, when you're skiing down a ski slope and you're no longer thinking about what you're doing at all, but you're in the flow of it, those are the moments where we're most profoundly alive. And the art of radical aliveness is day by day by day, learning to be in the present. It starts with simple things like anchoring in your breathing, resting in your body. And then it matures and deepens when you start to realize that in the present moment, everything is sensation and perception. There's no thinking, because thinking is a representational tool. You represent something when you give it a name, like tree. But it, in the present moment, a tree is a mystery, and so are people, and so are you yourself. And we get closer and closer to the present moment, and I think that's why people are taking the plant medicines, you know, because when we're in the exile of ourselves as a self system, this structure me that at the age of 30 dissolved, came back, but not much more transparent and conductive, dissolved again, came back even more transparent and conductive of what? Of kind of a living energy that's at the root of all of us when we get closer to the present in our bodies. And that level of aliveness in all these retreats I did, I mean, hundreds of retreats that lasted 10 days or longer, the whole aspect of these retreats were experiential to actually bring people to the experience of There was one man, he got a silver medal in the 1968 or so, 68 or 72 Olympics and the giant slalom. And there he is in one of my retreats sobbing because the last time he felt that alive was in the starting gate of the giant slalom. And if he's listening to this, if he's still alive, he'll recognize this. You know, he's sitting there crying. He couldn't close his hands. He was so full of light and energy. And I thought I'd never experience this again. And he went from a motivational speaker as a result of that retreat into ministry. When you get into that ground of yourself, you are intrinsically, in the true word, religious, and in, but not in the, let's say, dogmatic sense, and spiritual. And it's a different kind of intelligence. And so radical aliveness, that kind of aliveness, and it keeps you youthful. It keeps your mind constantly wanting to learn and enjoying life. And basically, you just have to learn how to come back to yourself and start again, moment by moment. Come back to yourself, start again right now. I always say, who you really are begins now.
So let's transition into the book we're here to talk about today, The Mandala of Being, Discovering the Power of Awareness. So the first question I would have for you before we get into the content is, what inspired you to write that book in the first place?
Well, the word's mandala. You know, you say mandala, but yeah, okay. And mandalas are sacred art forms from the East. I first became aware of mandalas when I was reading about Jung, talking about in dreams, people will spontaneously see circles and a mandala-type forms. And when they did, he believed that the psyche was in an integrating phase, a healing phase. But as an art form, a mandala is like a flower, like a daisy. And if you look at a daisy, it draws you right toward the center, to that dark center. But all these petals go outward. And if you imagine a consciousness that's both focused and spacious, that's what mandalas do. So what inspired me to write the book was that I had a carpet that I had found in Nepal in 1982. And I still have it. It's right here in my living room. And I often, you know, use it when there's a group here. And I stared at that mandala. It was at the center of my retreat facility. I stared at it for tens of thousands of hours, looking at a mandala. And one day, something just hit me so clearly. I went home and I had an argument with my wife, but I was always centered and grounded when I was teaching, when I was sitting in a group. Nothing triggered me. I was deep in the ground of myself. I asked myself, what am I doing differently when I'm home? And I realized I was letting my mind go into the past, the future, and judgments of her, judgments of situations, and so forth. I stood up with this carpet in front of me, and I said to this group of people, when you're right at the center of the mandala, that's the now, that's the present moment, that's when we know love directly. That's when we feel the peace that passeth understanding. It's sort of what the athlete feels when they're in a state of flow, and it can go deeper than that. But, and then I traced it like a clock, and I said, if you're in the future, and I walk to like 12 o'clock on the clock, then your mind is going to be in hope or fear, right? And you're going to start thinking hopeful thoughts, enthusiastic thoughts, or fearful thoughts. Or you step over here to 6 o'clock, now your mind's in the past, and you're reminiscing positively or negatively, and you're using the past to justify whatever mood or state of being you're in. And over here at 9 o'clock, those are all the stories and beliefs you have about yourself, right? And those are going to make you either inflated or deflated. They're going to make you grandiose or depressive because you can't actually have a thought about who you really are. That's impossible. Just turn and look for yourself and say, who am I really? And well, then if you have a thought, well, I'm better than that person, or I'm not as good as that person, well, there you are, either bigger or smaller. And then the same thing with this kind of clock image, the mandala image. It's now at the center. Over at 3 o'clock, it's all the thoughts we have and judgments we have of people and situations. It's all the nonsense we spew at each other about who we are and aren't. And that's how the mandala was born. Sometime in the early 90s, and by the time I, you know, really learned to teach it and created a workbook for it and brought it all over the place, you know, that's all these many years. I'm not sure I answered your question, but that's That's how it was born. That's why I did it. And why I called it a mandala is because I was looking at one.
That makes sense. But so then there's the subtitle, which is enticing, right? Discovering the power of awareness. Obviously, if somebody's listening to this and they're nodding along, hey, this sounds pretty neat. I could use some more spiritual peace in my life. So how does one begin to discover that power of awareness?
Well, when you're aware inside of your self system, what we sometimes call the ego, what all of us mean when we say me or I, you're usually inside of your moods, you know, instead of aware of your moods. You have thoughts, but they're driving your beliefs. They're driving your behavior. If you can step outside a little bit and say, I have thoughts, but I can be aware of my thoughts. I can be more than my thoughts. I have feelings, but I can turn my awareness toward these feelings and I can begin to become a student of my anxiety, a student of my loneliness. And I can learn from this. So I have these feelings, but I have awareness in the deeper ground means I'm much more than that. It's all arising in my mind. My mind's creating it, but I have an awareness that's more than just that level of mind. And so you learn. You learn to ask the question, what am I telling myself now that's making me angry? What am I believing about that person that's making me angry? And then you look at your own judgments and you go, so what's the truth of a judgment? Well, the truth of a judgment isn't the judgment. It's that it makes you angry, or it makes you inferior, or it makes you feel superior. In other words, the truth of a thought is the emotion it activates in the moment. And that's radical for people. And if you're unhappy, it's not because of what someone else has done. It's never because of someone else it's done. It's what you say to yourself about what they've done. And that makes you resentful, or bitter, or angry, or inferior, or superior. And you're just like an ever-changing weather system of emotional reactivity that's created by thinking. And so the mandala teaching, the mandala book, was a very step-by-step way of trying to guide people. It's my least mystical book. It basically outlines the progression of consciousness from infancy and onward, until the self system about 8 or 9 years old is fully established, and until something wakes us up and we start to become aware of our thoughts and take responsibility for them, aware of our feelings and take responsibility for them. And that's a lifetime process and a lifetime practice. It's day by day. Every day I say with my own spiritual meditative practice, this practice is for today. For how I'm going to greet today, for how I'm going to meet something that surprises me today, surprises me in a nice way, or I got scammed and hacked and lost my email account about 3-4 weeks ago. It's taken dozens of hours to fix that up. And I had to sit in that with tech people and I got up even earlier in the morning and did my practice to be in my ground so I wouldn't be telling myself stories about the future primarily when they steal my identity. I mean, it was quite a wild ride.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. As I'm hearing you talk, I'm seeing a lot of parallels on the clinical side of the house. You know, what you're describing in many ways mirrors the model of cognitive behavioral therapy as to how, you know, we view the world, ourselves, and others. And, you know, in some ways, you're also talking about an external versus internal locus of control. And we know that the data shows that those people, I've said this many times on this show and others, people that have an inherently internal locus of control and believe that they can control, they can't control the weather, they can't control the stock market or who's in office and what laws pass and what wars start, but they can control how they respond to it and respond to others. And that's exactly what you're talking about. So, you know, the little science part of my brain is saying, yep, there's a corollary to everything you're saying. I do have a question, and it's really your opinion, but what you've said is that this is really about being able to have awareness and responsibility of your thoughts and your feelings. It feels to me that as a society, we are worse than that than ever before at any point in time in our history, or as long as I can recall. So, one, I'm curious if you agree with that sentiment, and two, how the teachings of this book can help people with that.
Yes, I do agree. We've more and more moved in what could be called the left brain dominance. We are less and less able to recognize that in the present moment, everything is sensation, that everything you can have a relationship with it. We're always in the future now. We're always in kind of, we've made ourselves into images and we're selling ourselves as an image. We make ourselves into objects and you know, we become influencers, or how many people like us on this or that social media. And there's such an overwhelming objectification of everything. Everything is like an object to our left brain and a representation of reality. That's not an answer I want to give. I think AI is a replication of what our left brain does. It can't actually gestalt the way the right brain does, the way the right brain presences, the way the right brain thinks holistically and more intuitively. So as we get into this more and more left brain state, and there's a wonderful book called The Master and His Emissary. I'm pretty sure you've come across that. And if you haven't, you're going to love it. And I wish I could think of his name right now, but my mind has gone blank. He writes about this really, really well. So I am concerned about the co-opting of our attention. Attention is the instrument that you have that determines whether you will collapse into a feeling or have a relationship with a feeling. Attention is the instrument you have to be attentive to your thinking and see, this thinking is now closing my heart. It's making me angry. It's making me separate, to feel separate. Awareness has to be in service to something. You know, self-awareness has to be in service to something. And that something, from my point of view, is the very nature of the ground of reality, which is love. So you begin to learn to ask a question, if you're sane, what does love want? And it's not, what does power want? What does wealth want? What does fear want? Because fear wants security. And how am I going to have the security? Well, let me make more money. Let me store up more money in my investments and this and that. So most people are using their awareness to be safe. And there's nothing you can do to make yourself secure until you turn around and have a relationship with insecurity. Insecurity is a sensation. Anxiety is a sensation. Fear is a sensation. It can be an extreme sensation, but you can have a relationship with it. Last year, I was treated for prostate cancer with radiation at the Mayo Clinic. But before I got there, I had an MRI, I had tests. It was clearly a tumor in my prostate. And so they did a PET scan to see if it had metastasized. And you know, I have a lifetime practice that's underneath all this. And I saw the results of the PET scan before any doctor had called me on my portal, my medical portal. And there it says, the pathologist says, either I have a metastatic prostate cancer in my liver or a primary liver cancer. And I saw that. And despite everything I've lived, I instantly had fear, an intense fear. So I called my wife, who was home, and I said, look at what I just saw. Sit with me. And I sat up right next to her, kind of leaning a little bit into her. And I closed my eyes and I dove into that sensation, fear. Why do people chase after money? Fear. Why do two people want a facelift? Insecurity, fear. Why do we overeat? Why do we're trying to sedate feelings. We're trying to do all those things. I just dove into I relaxed and breathed and let go into the most extraordinary sensation And it only was a few minutes, the phone rings out of nowhere, and it's the oncologist who says, I can't believe these results. It certainly doesn't make sense, you know, with your clinical presentation and the information we have. You need an MRI. 8 days later, I had, or 6 days later, they rushed it. I had an MRI. It was benign tumors in my liver. But I had a chance to be with fear once again. And the reason I say that is because when you say what's happening in the world, if you run from fear, fear chases you into your mind, and then your mind will tell you how to be safe or who's making you unsafe. And then you're off to the races with war and racism and anti-Semitism and hate and this party versus that party. And people are just trapped in their minds, trapped, trapped, trapped. And they are completely the victims of feelings, and they like exciting their own emotional world. It's as if I'm angry, that justifies my belief in something. If I'm righteous, then it justifies something. Actually, it means you're completely off course. You're not listening to reality. You are not. Reality is about the coherence of love. Nature is a gigantic, extraordinary celebration of creativity. If you just open your eyes and look, you realize that if you have a thought and it's making you angry, you're thinking the wrong way. And you're responsible for that thought. And that's the only thing that's going to save mankind, not AI. Because we'll just use AI to be safe, or we'll use AI to hurt people.
I read something today, actually, that said we lose our ability is lessened to do complex problem solving if we become reliant on AI. And then AI is taken away from us. So it's, in fact, at my son's school, they've banned AI because kids are using it for everything. And I think there's a danger there because it's very seductive, right? To use it and have a conversation with it. Now, you know, the apps left to actually talk to you, like auditorially, right? You'll have a real conversation with this thing that it's just a construct. All it is a construct.
That's so important what you say. But what we have to understand, what happened to me when I was 30 years old was I realized Richard Moss, this person with his history and all that he had done or not done at that point in time at 30 years of age, was also a construct. Me is a construct. And ultimately, the people, the great souls that we would all acknowledge are exceptional in some way, they've all found a way to relax that construct into a deeper relationship with whatever you want to call it, the transcendent, the divine. For me, it's nice to call it love with a capital L, or maybe every letter is capitalized. Me is a construct. When I taught a lot in Europe, there's in France in particular, they have a whole thing. The French go looking for so-called sects. And there I was, a Western guy, an American, teaching a lot in Europe, and they had listed me as a sect, even though I don't have followers and I don't hypnotize people and I never did any of that stuff. And all of my retreats, anyone could have attended, and you know, there was nothing of that nature. But I used to love to play a joke with the French, and I would say, you know, the only sect we have to worry about is the sect of moi, the sect of me, you know. And until we have deeper awareness, it brings us to the ground of who we are beneath our me, you, past and future stories, which is what the mandala book process is about. And until we know that, every one of us in our individualistic illusion of separateness causes suffering and is suffering.
You said something earlier that was interesting, and I want to clarify it with you. You talked about that people today are spending too much time, if I heard you properly, living in the future. And I would argue that the future can be very adaptive. If you are struggling with something and you can visualize that your life is better by doing something different, and then that becomes habit, that there can be power in utilizing the future. But I'm curious as to why you frame that as a concern about society.
Well, if you postpone meeting a feeling that you've been running from all your life with an imaginary future, you know, then if you're going to really change the future, you need to come into the present, into a ground inside of yourself where intrinsically you have a sense of trust. And then you say to yourself, you know, I just met the most difficult sensation of fear, and I'm still breathing. In fact, I'm more expansive and relaxed now in some strange way. I know I'll be able to meet fear in the future. I know I'll be able to meet loneliness in the future because I'm meeting it right now. I'm turning my awareness toward what I'm feeling right in this moment. I'm not being chased into stories about the past, stories about the future, stories about myself and others. I'm in this direct relationship, this radical relationship with what I'm feeling right now. And it's not destroying me. It's teaching me how to relax. It's teaching me how to slowly diffuse my identity that's resisting reality, that's fighting against life moment by moment in some way. And then from that ground, I know I'll meet whatever life brings. In a way, it's like a prayer, and it's not different than what you're saying. Because if you can visualize a way you want to be, then start right now. If you can visualize yourself meeting a challenge in the future in a place inside of you that's more patient and open-hearted, then start right now. For me, I would start right now, but I would stop the future at the end of the day. Not, you know, when I have built my business up and I have this much money, or when I found the right woman and now we've got our kids in the house, you know, some, you know, that I'm building. I would say today, I want to know that I'm going to meet whatever comes to me, because you never know what's going to come. It can be wonderful or not. You can have a stroke. You can learn a friend has killed themselves. You can get a bigger tax bill. The question is, can you touch whatever is happening right now softly enough, relaxed enough, that it doesn't destabilize you into emotional reactivity, doesn't make you angry, doesn't make you anxious, you know? And if you are anxious, can you quiet enough down and feel that feeling and learn to touch it softly? Really, the secret to coming home to ourselves is relaxing. And what we're relaxing is not the sensation we don't want, it's the one that's fighting the sensation. When you stop fighting fear, fear is incredible aliveness. I remember when, you know, fear would visit me over and over again. I called it the sugar cube fear. You know, the sugar cube, Richard, this construction, if it's in really cold water, it's only losing its edges very slowly. But if it gets into hot water, woof. And so there's certain kinds of, you know, fear that belong to the process of transformation, the process of being evolved in consciousness. And you have to turn toward it. One day I just said to that same familiar fear, okay, take me, do what you want with me. And the instant I said that, which was a genuine, it was spontaneous, I wasn't thinking, it was a genuine non-reaction, you know. It wasn't that I was accepting it, I was just saying, okay, take me, do what you want. In that instant, I was in wonderful, just perfect peace. So when you see an emotion transmute, you know, by the quality of your touch, by the quality of your relationship with it, then you understand, I'm not going to be the victim of fear next week, but I'll only work on today. I'm not going to be the victim of sadness next month if this or that happens. I'm going to work on a relationship with my sadness right now, softly. And as each day goes by, one day at a time, you transform the future. You literally build a new future. But you do it by starting in the ground of yourself in the present moment and stepping away from the things that pull you into judgments of yourself and judgments of others. I mean, if you're in a certain kind of mood, it's not that the past is real. You know, the only past that is actually real that you can resurrect exactly the same would be if you memorized a poem, or if you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, that's anchored in the brain in a different way. All the rest of our past is subjective. So if you're angry at someone or unhappy about yourself, you'll select something from the past that justifies exactly what you're feeling in that moment. And you'll believe that that's the only past. But what the mandala book shows us is that's a story you're telling yourself. And you're selecting the past to justify your own unhappiness or your own loneliness or your own anger. You'll only remember the things about your father that were bad in one state of consciousness. But if you're in a different state, you'll remember he did his best or he tried this or that. Yes, he had his foibles, but, you know, so you can't trust the past. It's completely malleable. And you can even implant memories. So you have to learn to be in yourself. That's what radical aliveness is, to come to this moment and start again. And the reason I emphasize one day is because if you get to the end of this day and you flowed with the day with less resistance, because the ego is a structure that forever resists the present moment, just doesn't want reality to be the way it is, wants to be able to make reality over in the way it wants. It's always saying no. It's always being dissatisfied, always chasing satisfaction. If for one day you're not chasing satisfaction and you're breathing and listening and attuned, and the next day you'll start again. And the effect after a couple of months or a couple of years is a radically changed person and a radically changed life. So you have influenced the future, but you did it one day at a time.
Outstanding. I've loved our conversation today, Richard. I can't believe how quickly the time has flown by. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question, and that is, what is your biggest helping, the single most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
You have a divine spark within you. You're not the victim of your mind. You can learn to love love. You can say, what does love want? Before you open your mouth and say something to someone, you can say, what does love want right now? And then decide what you're going to say or what you're not going to say.
The book, The Mandala of Being, Discovering the Power of Awareness, is available everywhere. And there's a brand new audiobook for that as well. But if somebody wants to learn more about you, Richard, where can they find you online?
www.richardmoss.com.
Easy peasy. And we'll have links to everything Richard Moss, including the book, in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Well, Richard, I loved our conversation today. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
I really like meeting you.
I did as well. This was a great conversation, and I'm hoping we have many more. And to each and every one of you, I appreciate you as well. If you like what you heard, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.